Thank you. Sorry for going over.
Not a problem. Our next speaker is Larry Funk, and most of you will have probably heard or seen him at previous ASA meetings. He is a longtime chemistry prof here at Wheaton and contributor to this recent book that Wheaton has put together on origins, and so he's the guy to talk to about origins of life from a chemical perspective. Larry, take it away.
Thank you, Rod. I'm going to depart from my usual approach and actually read this because I know I can get through it in 20 minutes if I read it. One of the most difficult and most intriguing questions facing modern science is, how did life begin? It can be argued that the origin of life is fundamentally a problem that can be reduced to one involving the origin of biological information. I found the clearest, most direct, and perhaps most extravagant statement to this effect in an article by the origin of life scientist Niels Lehmann that he wrote back in 2008. The origin of life was probably the most significant chemical transition in the history of the universe. It relied on the advent of a new phenomenon, namely the origin of information. Might I add in passing that Lehmann is my middle name and my mother's maiden name, but I don't think I'm related to Niels Lehmann. These twin origins questions of life and of biological information in turn can give rise to deep philosophical or theological questions of agency. Does the origin of biological information and therefore of life require the action of an intelligent agent? Or can their origins be attributed to the outcome of so-called natural phenomena susceptible to scientific analysis and explanation? My purpose in this brief talk is not to answer all of these questions. That would be impossible. Rather, I will try to address their shape, particularly the question on the nature of biological information, and then I will offer a proposed response to the question of agency. We must begin by first defining our terms. The term life itself is not easily defined, and there has been a considerable amount of discussion in the scientific literature about its definition. Among origin of life scientists, there is a widespread tendency to avoid an explicit definition. Similarly, there is a hesitance to define a clear boundary separating life from non-life in the various scenarios proposed for the progression from inorganic matter to simple single-celled organisms that everyone would agree are alive. Meanwhile, a widely accepted definition is the simple one proposed by NASA, a self-sustaining chemical system capable of Darwinian evolution. For the purposes of this talk, we will adopt this definition. My main focus will be on the origin of biological information, so I want to spend more time on its definition. Just as in the case of life, there is not a uniformly accepted definition of the term biological information. I will propose a definition that is consistent with at least one of the candidates. Consider first the word information. If we go to the dictionary, we find two very different definitions. And I might add, I'm not related to this funk either. Number one, knowledge acquired or derived. And number two, any distinct signal element forming part of a message or communication, especially one assembled and made available for use by automatic machines as a digital computer, usually measured in bits. Can we co-opt either of these definitions for our definition of bioinformation and simply insert the word biological to identify its location? Clearly, the first one does not work. We don't find or ever expect to find knowledge or meaning in the usual senses of those words vested in molecular entities like DNA or proteins. On the other hand, the second definition seems more amenable. The four nucleobases in DNA function very much like letters in an alphabet. We can readily convert these into a digital code so that a particular DNA sequence can be reduced to a sequence of zeros and ones and stored in a computer. Our DNA can be thought of as a message which is translatable from one so-called language, that of DNA, into another with a different alphabet. Proteins have 20 different amino acids serving as the letters in their alphabet. Thus, three nucleotides are required per amino acid in the biological coding system, as illustrated on the slide. Nine nucleotides translate into a polypeptide with three amino acids. The translation occurs with RNA as the intermediary in the ribosome. All of this can be represented and coded in machine language, fulfilling definition number 2. But is that the complete story? I would argue not. DNA's behavior in the living cell fits this definition quite nicely. It serves as essentially a storage molecule for biological information in the sense just described, a relatively passive role. In contrast, proteins, and to an increasingly apparent extent, many RNA molecules, perform vital functions in the organism. Thus, they carry digitizable information in the second sense of the term. But more significantly, this information finds expression in literally vital processes that these molecules carry out to sustain life, as represented by this diagram showing a small portion of the metabolic activity accomplished via the catalytic action of proteins. Moreover, the behavior of proteins and RNA molecules is highly context dependent, varying with such things as concentration, pH, presence of cofactors, substrate availability, temperature, etc. If we return to our dictionary definition for the word information, we see that it is quite feasible to apply the first definition to these bioinformational molecules if we change the word knowledge to life-supporting function. Thus, proteins and many RNA molecules carry bioinformation in both senses of the term. They possess a sequence of units that can be represented by letters and digitized in the second sense, but they also perform biological functions that are variable and strongly context-dependent, and are therefore better described in analog rather than digital terms. Employing both senses of the word information in our definition of biological information provides us with a greater capacity for understanding the significance of the concept as we address the question of its origin. One way of thinking about this is to recognize that there is an analogical relationship between what we might call ordinary or everyday information that we access in newspapers or books, and bioinformation that is vested in the molecular structures of DNA, RNA, and proteins. We can develop the analogy further. Think of DNA as being like a book in a library, or better yet, stored on your computer. Both the book and DNA contain information, but only in the second sense, the one that can be algorithmically reduced by digitizing. Any book can be reduced to a digital record involving a sequence of ones and zeros, fulfilling the second definition. But not until the book is read and meaning is conveyed is the information actualized in the first sense. Similarly, not until DNA is transcribed into RNA and/or translated into protein is the biological information in the second sense actualized in a functional manner. Thus, biological information can be interpreted to include the requirement of life-sustaining functionality for the molecules said to contain it, except for DNA, which retains only the more passive role of information storage. Returning now to the question of life's origin, which necessarily must also involve the origin of this biological information. Regardless of the hypotheses chosen for the origin of life, central to the proposals is the origin of biological information molecules. The origin of the nucleic acids, the proteins, and the relationships between them required to initiate and to sustain life. But the question of life's definition again rises to the surface when we confront the question of its origin. The most popular current theory is known as the RNA world. In its purest form, it postulates the appearance in a primordial soup of certain RNA molecules that were capable of catalyzing their own replication. Such RNA replicases would contain information both in sense 2, a la DNA, and also in sense 1, through their autocatalytic functionality. However, there are many other processes in addition to reproduction, particularly metabolic ones, that must be performed for life to exist. So the RNA world requires the appearance of other RNA enzymes, known as ribozymes, to perform these catalytic functions. In all of these cases, RNA functionality as an enzyme engaging both in replication and metabolism, biological information is proposed to be originating, and the ability of these systems to engage in Darwinian-like evolution fulfills the NASA definition of life. Farther along in the story, proteins come into the picture, and their superior ability as catalysts lead to their takeover of that function. Some of the RNA morphs into the more chemically stable DNA for information storage, while the rest of the RNA retains some of its catalytic and most of its translational capacities. Thus, the remaining RNAs continue to function as go-betweens in translation into proteins and in relatively minor catalytic roles. All of these later steps involve extension and expansion of biological information in a functional sense. The RNA world is not without its significant detractors and competitors. Many of these distinguish themselves from the RNA world theory by proposing a far greater and earlier role for polypeptides, the non-coded versions of proteins, in the story. For example, in one theory, it is suggested that biological information in a solely non-digital, that is, analog form, existed prior to the appearance of linear digitized version involving RNA. It is proposed that what the biologists call homeostasis came into existence and could be retained in cell division without any genetic involvement. In other words, metabolism preceded genetics. Whether such a system that lacks the digital functionality of the nucleic acid-based genetic system could undergo Darwinian evolution and thus fulfill NASA's definition of life is a question that continues to be unresolved and debated in the literature. In another of the alternative theories, instead of focusing on self-replication as the key vital step in life's origin, the origin of the translation process, the transmission of coded information from RNA to protein, is considered to be paramount. It is suggested that RNA and polypeptides were involved in a cooperative, mutually autocatalytic process that gave rise to the genetic code and the translation process. This generally includes the postulate of a primitive version of the ribosome, the so-called proto-ribosome. The end result is a cell with the catalytic capability of self-replication. In other words, metabolism and genetics grew up together in a context capable of Darwinian change, fulfilling the NASA definition. For the purposes of our discussion, it is important to note that in all of these alternatives, the initial appearance of biological information occurs in the form of RNA and/or proteins, molecules performing chemical functions, not in the digitizable form of DNA. Thus, the origin of life, according to current thinking, involves the origin of biological information in the first sense of that term, through the appearance of molecules that have a chemical life-sustaining function, not merely a passive digitized information storage role. Returning now to the philosophical question raised at the beginning of the talk, does the origin of biological information and consequently also the origin of life require the action of an intelligent agent, or can they be attributed to the outcome of so-called natural phenomena susceptible to scientific analysis and explanation? When phrased in this manner, the question is of the either-or sort, requiring a yes to one of the propositions and a no to the other. Thus, proponents of intelligent design, such as Stephen Meyer, would answer in the affirmative to the requirement of an intelligent agent, and in the negative on the question of natural processes giving rise to biological information. Meyer, in his seminal work, Signature in the Cell, consistently argues against the various attempts at a scientific explanation of the origin of biological information and of life. He draws no categorical distinction between biological information and the information resident in human communication via language, since both, he argues, exhibit what he calls specified complexity and are reducible to digitized versions. Since human communication is in spoken or written language requires an intelligent source, he argues that biological information does also. In so doing, he fails to distinguish between meaning that is vested in human communication and functionality that is exhibited by biological molecules, especially RNA and proteins. As I argued above, I believe these two forms of information are only loosely related analogically. Therefore, I would suggest, contrary to Meyer, that whereas human communication occurs only via intelligent agency, biological information does not require intelligent agency. Meanwhile, in contrast, the atheist, Richard Dawkins, in The Blind Watchmaker, holds firmly to the proposition that the appearance of biological information and life are purely the result of physical-chemical processes with no indication of any intelligent agency. He recognizes, however, the extreme difficulty of explaining, based on our current knowledge, the first appearance of biological information in the form of self-replicating RNA molecules. He resorts to an argument based on probabilities, contending that there are likely enough Earth-like planets in the universe as a whole to offset the apparently small likelihood of biological information's initial appearance. The Blind Watchmaker, in which he makes this suggestion, was written in the 1980s. We might wonder if there has been significant progress made in resolving the scientific question of biological information's origin that would change Dawkins' response. Well, despite several decades of intensive research, the question remains an open one. As noted earlier, there are various theories currently vying for attention, but the origin of biological information and the origin of life continues to be challenging mysteries. So for both Meyer and Dawkins, faced with the question on the requirement of agency for the origination of biological information, the options appear to be yes or no. Is there any other alternative? I would like to suggest one. If we again return to the original question, we can create the possibility of an alternative response by minor alterations in the question itself. If we modify the first part to remove the logical necessity implied by the word require and replace the word or by the word and, another answer becomes possible. Consider this alternative. Are the origin of biological information, and consequently also the origin of life, consistent with the postulate of an intelligent agent? And can they be attributed to the outcome of so-called natural phenomena, susceptible to scientific analysis and explanation? When the question is modified in this manner, I believe the appropriate answer is an emphatic yes. I believe the extraordinary complexity and functional integrity of the created world that gave rise to the phenomenon that we call life is a testimony to the artful craft of an ultimate designer creator, the triune God. It can be argued that the essential nature of physical reality was structured in such a way that life was the ultimate outcome on this planet, and that the appearance of biological information was not an accident, to use Dawkins' term, but rather was the result intended and accomplished by the infinitely wise creator of the cosmos. I also believe that the appearance of life and biological information is susceptible to physical explanation. Origin of life science faces enormous hurdles because it happened so long ago under unknown conditions and the molecular record has long since disappeared. Moreover, based on our current incomplete understanding of the chemistry of nucleic acids, polypeptides, and their relationships, and our lack of knowledge regarding the conditions under which life began roughly 4 billion years ago, the appearance of functional bioinformational molecules in a prebiotic world may appear to have a low probability of occurrence. But that perception of small likelihood for life's appearance may be a consequence of the limitations in our current science. We may never know for sure how it happened, but as theists, we can believe that God did it, however it occurred. And figuring out the processes he used continues to be an intriguing and fascinating challenge for our science. Hence, I would agree with many of my intelligent design brothers and sisters that there is an intelligent designer responsible for the marvelous phenomena that we observe, all the way from the Big Bang through the appearance of galaxies, stars, and planetary systems to the appearance of life on this planet. I might prefer to refer to him as a grand creative cosmic artist rather than an intelligent designer, and I would question the assumption that this belief in a creator prohibits him from creative action that involves process. Many aspects of his grand creative process are accessible to our scientific investigation and interpretable in terms of our scientific theories. Some explanations are easier to achieve than others. The origin of life and biological information may be among the hardest, but I do not think it is an inherently insoluble mystery, though we may never be certain of the correctness of any proposed solution given the nature of the case. And I think I did it in less than 20.
I was impressed with Larry's presentation, and I was even more impressed with his timeliness. Larry, all right, answer a few questions. Okay. We've got 5 minutes or more.
Yes.
I recall a talk given several years ago by Randy Eisler, in which he was somewhat critical of the intelligent design statement that biological systems are just like a book, you know, it's a language. I remember him concluding with a statement that chemistry is different from written language. And I think one way of thinking of that is that would allow for long times for processes to occur would be that hydrogen bonding is always there. So A and T are always going to pair, G and C are always going to pair. So the language is never lost, even if these molecules are sitting around in a pool or adhere to a rock somewhere for several millennia. On the flip side, a written language or a human developed language, even though it's reducible to binary bits in a computer, can be lost. And archaeologists know of several artifacts where there's a written language, but they can't read it because the information's been lost. The information's been lost because there's nothing like hydrogen bonding or something that's going to last forever that allows us to translate it.
Yeah, another example of the fact that it's really, there's an analogical relationship between the two, but they're really, I would contend they're in really different categories. They're only analogically related.
Yeah. Chemistry will always be there.
Right.
The mind that created language won't always be there. Okay.
Question, yes?
I think you would say that God created the process by which, let's say, the first living cell, which, by the way, were very primitive compared to our modern cells. But I think you would say God created the first process by which the first cell evolved. But therefore, God was not required to intervene to put the parts together to get that first cell to work, as Michael Behe, I think, would claim. You favor the process, that God doesn't have to intervene, he created the process, and that's enough.
Even more than that, I would contend that God is involved in the process in some mysterious way. We don't understand how God's action occurs in the world, but we would hold, and it occurs to me, Richard Bube talked about what would happen if God turned himself off. and the answer is everything would just go out of existence. It wouldn't be that the laws would stop working, you know, the processes wouldn't continue. We'd go out of existence. Okay.
He maintains the process.
He maintains the process and is involved somehow in the process. Okay, in ways that we can't understand. We can't know about those connections.
So I'm going to suggest we have time for one more question or two more short questions.
So I don't think Michael Behe requires direct intervention. I think it'd be fine with a process, but that process is not going to be random. The process is going to be clearly designed to have done it, right? So I think that's all that we're really talking about here. It's such a fine distinction, and no way people keep on arguing about it, because it's very clear to me as a computer scientist that this is programming. This does not happen randomly. It cannot happen randomly. And even Darwinian evolution, random changes, that's not going to make things the way things are.
I would agree with you. In fact, I'm not arguing against Behe, okay? I'm more calling into question the complete rejection of any idea of process, which I seem to see in, not in Behe's work necessarily, but in Meyer's work. And maybe I'm misreading Meyer, but I looked in Signature and so I read it, and I went back and looked, and I can't find any affirmation of process. He simply argues against any scientific effort to try to understand.
One more.
Yeah. One of the ways I like to think about this is to say God
does some things in his customary way, which are misnamed the laws of nature. Okay? I like to thank him as God's customary way of creating. And miracles are God doing something in an extraordinary way. And I think when it comes to the origin of life, this idea that he probably did some combination, and we don't necessarily have to be able to explain all of the details, but I do think it's very hard to imagine how this could have happened strictly by process.
Well, I try to imagine what it would have been like if we had been able to observe the phenomenon occurring, and would we have seen anything that we would have considered to be a violation of physical principles that we've come to understand. I like to think that we would not see anything that would be odd, even though it might have looked like it was rather improbable. But that, you know, even there, how do we define probabilities? It's really a hard question to resolve. Okay.
All right. On that last word, let's give Claire another round of thanks.